April 1965, a Canadian warship was sent to Santo Domingo. Paul Theodore Heller, Canada's Minister of Defense at the time, explained that this deployment was in order for Canada to stand by case it is required. Two Canadian gunboats were also deployed to the Independence Celebration in Barbados the following year, a bizarre diplomatic maneuver that was designed to demonstrate Canada's military prowess. According to a Canadian War Museum exhibition, during the war, Canadians became especially good at train busting. This meant running in close to shore, usually at night, and risking damage from Chinese and North Korean artillery in order to destroy trains or tunnels on Korea's coastal railway. Of the 28 trains destroyed by United Nations warships in Korea, Canadian vessels claimed 8. The official record Canadian naval operations in Korean waters 1950 to 1955 details a large number of RCN attacks that would have likely killed civilians. Further back in time, Canadian warships were also dispatched to force Costa Rica to negotiate with the Royal Bank in 1921 and protect British interests during the Mexican Revolution, and back to dictator massacring peasants in El Salvador in 1932. Where do Canada's political parties stand on the new frigates brimming with missiles? It was Stephen Harper's Conservatives who instigated this massive naval expenditure, while the Liberals have happily continued down the same path. For its part, the center-left New Democratic Party has yet to object to the initiative, while the Bloc Quebeco has simply pressed for more shipyard work in Quebec. Canada's real track record in world affairs bears very little resemblance to the smug and self-satisfied stories it tells about itself. Instead of proffering olive branches, it is spending $100 billion to strengthen its Navy capacity for throwing its weight around, all in support of U.S. imperialism and Canadian corporations abroad. And with no sign of dissent coming from the Canadian political class, that pattern of duplicity looks set to continue.
Aperture.
Agent Orange, a chemical cocktail that became notorious as a defoliant, was used in aerial bombardments against the Viet Cong in the Vietnam War. The U.S. military sprayed millions of gallons of Agent Orange onto Vietnam's jungles during the conflict to expose northern communist troops. 40 years since the end of the war, people in Vietnam with severe mental and physical disabilities still feel the lingering effects of Agent Orange. Its legacy of death and deformity is well documented. Cancer and birth defects amongst both Vietnamese and U.S. veterans have been linked to exposure to the defoliant. But what is less known is how Agent Orange was used after the war. I'm Zarin Shajari, and this is Aperture. Agent Orange is made up of the chemicals 245T and 24D. In the 1960s and 70s in Australia, the solution used in weed eradication often involved the spraying of herbicides 245T and 24D with terrifying consequences. Sprayers were often exposed to the deadly poison without any protective gear. Many sprayers died young, one after another. But still, this is not the full extent of the problems caused by the chemicals. Stay with us as we meet the families of former government employees who have died almost certainly as a result of their exposure.
Thirty-one-year-old Nigel Sinclair is in the last stage of terminal cancer. Nigel and his family believe he's soon to be the latest legacy from a chemical exposure which they say has killed his father, his uncle, and many of their mates. Before Nigel dies, he wants to know how a tragedy like this could happen.
At this very late stage, what would be the very best outcome for you?
You know, it's like answers, really, just so my nana can rest and, you know, I can rest and my family can rest and put it to rest.
I'm lucky that he's still with us and still going. He has his moment where he'd like to have his closure.
Back in the 1970s and 1980s, hundreds of men were employed by the various state governments around the country to spray noxious weeds. Today, many are sick and many are dead.
A lot of the boys end up being the same, fading away near enough to nothing. Doctors turn and just, feed your medication, kill the pain. You're right, you'll be right. Next thing you know, they're dead.
Nigel's father was one of about 320 men in the West Australian Kimberley who sprayed herbicides for the state's Agriculture Protection Board, or APB. Now, there are reports of the sprayer's partners and children getting sick.
I think that they should have a close look, epidemiologically and clinically, at the children of those APB workers. I think that they should suspect that they'll have huge problems to deal with.
Mr. Hunter, Nigel's father, was one of many Indigenous men who joined the government spraying teams.
They work from sun up to sundown for what pay they got, little knowing that they're going to die later on in later years.
What the men didn't know was the herbicides they were spraying from backpacks were the same chemicals used to make Agent Orange in the Vietnam War, 245T and 24D, which were contaminated with dangerous dioxins.
Poison was carried on the same vehicle as their water drums, and their swags and everything used to get soaked with the poison. They slept in it, worked in it for 10 days at a time. And all their clothes will get washed at home.
It wasn't an accidental spill on any workday. Their bodies were exposed to the herbicide all day, and I'm not talking about 8 hours in the day, but 24 hours a day, every week, for months and years. I can't conceive of anywhere where the exposure has been so intense and at such a level and for so long.
One of the workers, Carl Drysdale, said they would cart the drums of chemicals in the back of a four-wheel drive. The sprayers would go into the bush for 10 days at a time. For the first few years, the men were given no protective clothing.
Most of the people would be wearing what was appropriate for the heat, which would be shorts and thongs and T-shirts, you know.
A few years after spraying the chemicals, many of the men began to get sick.
Now, in the beginning, what were you told about the chemicals? How safe were they?
Harmless. So harmless you could drink it.
That's what they told you?
That's right.
Who told you that?
Oh, all the bosses, all the head shrinks.
But Carl Drysdale, who was the foreman, felt responsible for his men, and he was getting worried.
They all got rashes. Everybody got rashes, headaches, and I guess internal bleeding was another pretty universal thing, like they were vomiting blood and passing blood.
Carl wrote to his superiors in June 1982 about his concerns. A manager from the West Australian Agriculture Protection Board wrote back saying that 245T was not considered dangerous if used as recommended, and that he did not support staff undertaking their own research.
You're told that the stuff's harmless, so you think, well, you know, I'm probably wrong, so you give them the benefit of the doubt, you know? And that was a mistake to trust the government, you know?
The job was a perfect job for them, and they loved that kind of environment. Maybe if it had been a white person, they most probably would have stood up and said, well, I'm not spraying this, this doesn't smell nice, I'm getting a rash, I'm getting sores, I'm not touching this anymore. Well, they wouldn't, they didn't want to lose their job.
After years of spraying, Mr. Hunter became so ill that he could no longer work and was often bedridden. He had sores all over his body, respiratory problems, dramatic weight loss, and extreme fatigue.
His black arms were dyed white, you know, or bleached white, where that poison came in contact. He had great big lumps under his jaw, from his glands, under his arms, and he told me in his groin. His general health was so bad that he couldn't get up the stairs at work to get his pay.
At 33, Mr. Hunter died in his sleep. He was the first of the Kimberley men to die, but others soon followed.
How many of those men are still alive?
Not very many, and if any, they're sick today.
Mainly headaches at the moment, yeah.
For more than 30 years, Carl Drysdale has been fighting to get workers' compensation for the surviving men.
Kept me awake all night last night.
When are you going to see the doctor?
Carl himself has not been able to work since 1985 because of a range of illnesses he believes were linked to the spraying. His wife Marion has had to support him and their four children.
Carl has suffered from just about everything you can suffer from, and I've seen the physical decline in this powerful, energetic man since he finished with the APB.
I had like constant heart attacks, unconscious. They told my wife I was going to die over and over again. 5 black spots on my lungs. I've used cortisone cream for rashes that's ruined my bones.
Okay. And you just hold it level with your heart there. Okay.
Dr. Randolph Spargo was a local GP and saw many of the sprayers, including Carl Drysdale.
So it's definitely abnormal, Carl, but much better than used to be.
Have you got any doubt all these years later that it was the chemicals that made a lot of these men sick and in some cases killed them?
No doubt about it. I wouldn't go near that herbicide.
The herbicides were contaminated with dangerous dioxins. Chemical Industries Kwinana in Perth imported some of these chemicals, which were supplied to the West Australian Agriculture Protection Board.
According to their normal toxicity...
In 1978, Four Corners reporter Andrew Olley interviewed the owner, the late Robert Telford.
But it's not a commercial problem.
What do you mean it's not a commercial problem?
It's because it's not possible for a person using commercial 245T containing these minute infinitesimal quantities of dioxin to be poisoned by them.
How do you know that?
The toxicity becomes meaningless in the dilution.
A few years later, Professor Ben Salinger, a former head of chemistry at the Australian National University, traced some of the chemicals to Singapore, where one batch had been fire damaged.
The normal herbicide would have been light in colour and fairly fluid. The sample we had from the tariff board was clunky and black, so it would appear that there was a good chance they were using the stuff that we also looked at.
All of a sudden, at least 30, 44 gallon drums of concentrate arrived, and it was completely different to the stuff in the 20 litre drums. The stuff in the 20 litre drums was like engine oil and or honey, you know, colour. And the next lot came, it was black and thick, and it blocked up all the nozzles. And 30 drums was enough for at least 20 years.
Tests on a sample of the fire-damaged chemical later revealed it had 200 times the allowable level of dioxin then, and more than 2,000 times the levels permitted in later years.
Well, I think it would have been very dangerous. It was much higher than what was used in Vietnam. And at those levels, I think they were really exposed to a high level of risk.
The men continued to die.
They die with that sort of lingering question mark hanging over, why has this happened to me, you know? And to see that is terrible.
In 2001, occupational work specialist Dr. Andrew Harper was asked to investigate if the men's illnesses were linked to chemical exposure. Dr. Harper says the government's Agriculture Protection Board repeatedly failed in its duty of care.
One, they were not trained. Two, there wasn't an induction program. The information about the risk was not given to them. The supervision was not there. And they were not given, in the main, safety equipment. So they simply went out in shorts and shirts and thongs, and that was it. And there wasn't any systematic washing after exposure. So they were just completely exposed. And the authorities didn't take a responsible stand to, in fact, correct the situation.
Dr. Harper recommended all those who were sick be considered for compensation.
I recommended that compensation be considered, as I felt there had been a disservice done to all these people. And it wasn't only manifest in a specific illness, which was difficult to define. It was manifest through the way they were treated and through the impact that that had on their lives and on their feelings of alienation.
But the West Australian Labor government responded to Dr. Harper's recommendation by calling for another report.
Asking for a scientific study created a distraction from the content of my report.
That the men be compensated.
That the men be compensated. It diverted attention away from all of the injustices of the whole program. It diverted attention away from the suffering that these people had, and it diverted attention away from the moral issues that the whole thing exemplifies.
Former Agricultural Minister Kim Chance commissioned the new report.
Harper's report took us a long way because we began from a situation where we were trying to uncover the results of an event that occurred 20 years before. Harper's report allowed us to tie those events together. He said, look, it looks like there's a cause and effect issue here.
He was a lot stronger than that. He recommended that you consider compensation for all those men.
Yes.
He found a failure of duty of care by various governments.
Yes.
He found that there was no protective clothing, that these chemicals were suspected of being incredibly toxic, and no training. Why did you need statistics to compensate the men when you had all that before you?
Because our means of compensation is the WorkSafe principles or the WorkCover principles. That's the only means we have of compensating a former government worker.
I'd like to get a jar of that poison and pour it down some of those politicians' mouth. Let them see how they feel about it.
The new report recommended only men with cancer be eligible for compensation. 10 years later, only 8 men have received workers' compensation.
To effect what Dr. Harper wanted us to do required a change in the law.
Well, why didn't you change the law?
Well, that's a matter for the whole of government to deal with. That's way beyond the authority of the Minister for Agriculture.
Dr. Randolph Spargo said the men were actually poisoned.
Yes, they were. They were. And they were told that the chemical that they were using couldn't possibly hurt them.
In fact, they were told it was so safe they could drink it.
They could drink it.
I mean, given all that, do you now, all these years later, find it hard to reconcile that they were never compensated, not the great bulk of those men who got sick?
Yes.
If you could...
I'll go further than that. I think Dr. Harper's recommendation was the right recommendation.
Getting a rash on there too. It's all red on that side.
Despite this admission, nothing is likely to change for the children and partners of the sprayers, who believe they are now affected.
Slowly.
3 years ago, Nigel Sinclair was diagnosed with leiomyosarcoma, which is growing on a muscle at the back of his liver. Studies have linked soft tissue sarcoma with toxic exposure from Agent Orange, which was equal parts 245T and 24D.
Just battling to get up and walk around now. Just finding it hard to get out of bed and that, and had to get a new bed now, so... Yeah, and I'm more confined to a wheelchair. You put my shirt down now.
No mother wants to watch their son deteriorate like this. And it's something that can't fix, you know. Can't kiss it better, can't put a band-aid on it. And I just got to watch him. And I don't like to. Got to try and keep strong.
More than three decades ago, when Sue Sinclair was pregnant with Nigel, she used to wash his father's chemical-drenched clothes. After Nigel was born, she would put his nappies in the wash with his father's work gear. And Nigel would crawl all over his father and his swag.
Horrible to think that I might have passed something on to my son. Now, I'd take that away from him any day and put it on myself.
If dioxin was present, the residual level of dioxin in the clothes need not be very high to be potentially harmful. And these chemicals have got the potential to damage genes and produce an adverse effect in the next generation. And this is a real concern.
Of the 77 workers Dr. Harper interviewed, 58% reported having fertility problems, stillbirths, and premature births. There were 12 reports of birth defects.
Some of the blokes have described what their children look like, and I won't even say what they've said about their own children, what they look like. And
why? What was
they look
wrong?
Like monsters, you know, like because of the deformities that they had.
Back in 1976, on the other side of the country, in the small rural town of Yarram in Victoria's Gippsland, a cluster of birth defects was found by a local GP. Dr. Rod Guy told Four Corners he believed the deformities might be linked to heavy spraying of 245T and 24D.
Well, we made a list of the abnormalities, the problems we'd had.
I'd had some really awful things happen, which were really unusual. A baby born without a brain, a baby born without kidneys. Now, in general practice, it's unusual to have serious birth defects.
The Victorian government held an inquiry in 1978.
The disappointing thing was that I thought that the inquiry was really very superficial and, I think, to be honest, rushed to get a political answer.
The inquiry dismissed concerns that the chemicals were potentially dangerous and found that the cluster of birth defects in Yarram could have happened by chance. 2 years later, Professors Ben Salinger and Peter Hall found that there were serious statistical errors with that finding.
Peter Hall is probably one of Australia's best statisticians, and he did that work and showed that the way they did their comparisons would have minimised anything showing up. And when he redid the work using their data, he showed a very high and strong correlation.
So in other words, they were saying that there wasn't a disproportionate number of birth abnormalities.
That's right. Yeah. And his results showed that there were a very high proportion of birth abnormalities.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian Voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A national non-profit revealed that testing commissioned by the group, as well as separate analyses conducted by Massachusetts officials, show samples of an aerially sprayed pesticide used by the Commonwealth and at least 25 other states to control mosquito-borne illnesses contain toxic substances that critics called forever chemicals. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jessica Corbett Ryder. This article is published under the heading Tests Reveal Toxic Forever Chemicals in Aerial Pesticide Showered Over Millions of Acres in the United States. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. A national nonprofit revealed that testing commissioned by the group, as well as separate analyses conducted by Massachusetts officials, show samples of an aerially sprayed pesticide used by the Commonwealth and at least 25 other states to control mosquito-borne illnesses contain toxic substances that critics call forever chemicals. Officially known as per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS, this group of man-made chemicals, including PFOA, PFOS, and GenX, earned the nickname because they do not break down in the environment and build up in the body. PFAS has been linked to suppressed immune function, cancers, and other health issues. Lawmakers and regulators at various levels of government have worked to clean up drinking water contaminated by PFAS. The newly released results of pesticide testing by public employees for environmental responsibility, or PEER, and the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection, MADEP, generated alarm about the effectiveness of such efforts. In Massachusetts, communities are struggling to remove PFAS from their drinking water supplies, while at the same time, we may be showering them with PFAS from the skies and roads. PEER Science Policy Director Kyla Bennett, a scientist and attorney formerly with U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, said in a statement on Tuesday, December 1st. The frightening thing is that we do not know how many pesticides, herbicides, or even disinfectants contain PFAS, added Bennett, who arranged for the testing. PEER found patents showing chemical companies using PFAS in these products, and recent articles discusses the variety of pesticides that contain PFAS as either an active or an inert ingredient. The product tested initially by PEER and subsequently MADEP, once the nonprofit alerted the department of its findings, is Anvil 10+1, produced by the Illinois company Clark. Karen Larson, Clark's vice president of government affairs, told the Boston Globe that when this was first brought to our attention, we conducted an internal inquiry of our manufacturing and supply chain to ensure that PFAS was not an ingredient in the production, manufacturing, or distribution of either the active or inactive ingredients of Anvil. No PFAS ingredients are used in the formulation of Anvil, nor in the production of any source material in Anvil. PFAS components are not added at any point in the production of Anvil, she said. Larson added that while it is unclear why the Clark pesticide contained PFAS, the company will continue to work closely with the EPA to conduct the testing. PEER Executive Director Tim Whitehouse detailed the recent testing results in a letter sent last week to MADEP Commissioner Martin Suberg that called for the halting use of Anvil 10 plus 10, ensuring any replacement does not contain forever chemicals, and requiring pesticide companies to comprehensively test their products for PFAS. This fall, PEER conducted several tests for PFAS of a 2.5-gallon jug of Anvil 10 plus 10, the pesticide used in aerial spraying programs of Massachusetts and many other states across the United States of America. The test revealed that Anvil 10 plus 10 contains roughly 250 parts per trillion of perfluorooctanic acid, that is PFOA, and 260 to 500 ppt of hexafluoropropylene oxide dimer acid, that is HFPODA, a Gen X replacement for PFOA. Both these results are hovering around the detection limits of the laboratory's equipment, but there is no doubt that these PFAS are in the insecticide. While PFAS may be useful when added to pesticides as surfactants, dispersants, and antifoaming agents, it is unclear whether the PFAS found in Anvil 10 plus 10 is an ingredient added by the manufacturer, contained in one of the ingredients supplied to Anvil's manufacturer by other companies, or whether it is a containment from the manufacturing storage process. Moreover, since we were only able to test for 36 PFAS out of the 9,252 on the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's inventory, it is impossible to know how many other PFAS might be in the Anvil 10 plus 10, the researchers added. When PEER obtained its first positive PFAS results on Anvil 10 plus 1, we immediately contacted DEP because of the far-reaching implications, the researchers said. MADEP independently tested 9 samples of Anvil 10 plus 10 from 5 different containers and found 8 different PFAS, including PFOA and PFOS. Some PFAS levels were over 700 ppt. As such, there appears to be no doubt that there are PFAS in the pesticide Massachusetts has chosen for mosquito control. White House noted that Massachusetts aerially sprayed 2.2 million acres with Anvil 10 plus 10 last year and more than 200,000 acres this year. The Globe explained that most of the spraying has been done in southeastern part of the state where EEE, a rare but deadly mosquito-borne disease, has been most prevalent. The EPA, which has been lambasted by lawmakers as well as environmental and public health advocates for its handling of PFAS contamination on a national scale, is working on an analytical method to detect the forever chemicals in pesticides and plans to conduct its own tests of Anvil 10 plus 10, according to the newspaper. There are significant unanswered questions about the data currently available, Dave Deegan, a spokesperson for the federal agency's offices in New England, told the Globe. EPA will continue to work closely with and support the state on the issue. Bennett and other critics of the EPA's response to PFAS reiterated concerns about the agency in the wake of their revelations in Massachusetts. In a statement about the testing on Tuesday, December 1st, Food and Water Watch Executive Director Vino Hatter declared that these findings shocked the conscience. States likely have unknowingly contaminated communities' water with PFAS hidden in pesticides. Once again, the EPA has failed to protect the American people from harmful pollution. Emphasizing that we need to stop the introduction of toxic forever chemicals into the environment and the water sources to protect public health, Hatter said that EPA must ban all pesticides with PFAS components, designate PFAS as hazardous substances to hold polluters accountable for cleanup of contamination, and set strong, enforceable standards for PFAS in the drinking waters in the U.S. The GOP-controlled Senate must step up and pass the PFAS Action Act, which passed the House in January, to regulate these toxic compounds and hold polluters accountable. And U.S. Congress must pass the Water Act to provide the financial relief to community water providers and households which wells to remove PFAS from drinking water or find alternative sources where treatment fails, she added. Now is the time for decisive action to protect people's health and safety.
Around the World with Reporters.
As United States President Joe Biden keeps failing to honor his campaign promise to quickly undo the damage wrought by his predecessor on relations with Iran, Washington is grappling with the reality that it's now a very different geopolitical world. The just-signed $400 billion, 25-year Iran-China pact, which China's foreign minister called permanent, has been received with shock and awe across the Beltway. Washington's long-standing effort to totally isolate and blockade Iran has formally failed, while China's new ally provides a major energy obstacle to the Pentagon's militaristic pivot to Asia policy.
The foreign policy of the United States really does not change under Democrats or Republicans very much. So there's agreement in that area of the oligarchy on foreign policy. And foreign policy really is based on controlling basically the world.
The Economic and Security Alliance worsens the leverage of the United States, but they have repeatedly undermined their own bargaining position. In 2018, the United States illegally and unilaterally pulled out of the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy program and then began reimposing crippling economic sanctions designed to force Iran to renegotiate. Tehran insists compliance with the original pact is the only way forward and reiterated that the deal is still on the table if Biden returns the U.S. into compliance.
What should he do with Iran is he should get back into the agreement that Obama made, and we should be working with them to relieve the sanctions. They've actually done everything that the United States required of them. It's the foreign policy of the United States is totally immoral. So it's immoral towards Iran, as it is in many other places.
Iranian President Hassan Rouhani recently said that the lack of knowledge about Iran from American officials is ridiculous. Many analysts have been dumbfounded by the formal alliance. It's what many Americans now call woke, as it's between two nations of different colors, ethnicities, cultures, and cosmologies. Top American media is saying the next few weeks are make or break for the JCPOA, at least until September. The Biden administration is reportedly scrambling to present a new offer to Tehran as soon as next week. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
As the Yemeni army is pushing ahead with its offensive to liberate the city of Marib from Saudi-backed forces, Yemen's bloc of anti-aggression parties has held an event in the capital Sana'a to discuss the role of the southern and eastern Yemeni tribes in facing the Saudi-led coalition.
Many of the free people in southern Yemen stand beside their country in groups and parties, but they face severe repression from the forces of the coalition in southern regions, which confirms the ugliness of the crimes committed by the coalition against Yemenis. All Yemenis should be working together on a comprehensive plan to liberate all governorates after the liberation of Marib.
Since the beginning of the Saudi war in Yemen, eastern and western tribes played a key role in supporting the Yemeni army with weapons, money, and fighters. The participants say the tribes devoted their efforts to expel the foreign presence from their country.
The southern and eastern Yemeni tribes have many honorable stances, whether by spreading culture and awareness or supporting the political position inside and outside Yemen. They are also supporting the fronts of confrontation with weapons, men, money, and sending food convoys to the fighters on all fronts. The tribes are seeking to expel the foreign occupation from the country.
The Yemeni army has recently intensified its operations to liberate Marib, the last stronghold of the Saudi-backed forces in northern Yemen. A move which is considered as the first step forward for liberating the rest of the country.
Yemenis agree that the liberation of the country will not succeed without the tribes backing the army, since the tribes themselves refuse the presence of any foreign forces, especially those of Saudi Arabia. Abdul Latif Roshali, Sana'a.
The Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities says the UK system is not rigged against people from ethnic minorities and there is no proof of institutional racism. In a report released Wednesday, it did admit that minorities still face overt racism, but insisted Britain should be regarded as a, quote, model for other white majority countries.
The report definitely touched a nerve, suggesting that disparities based on race in the economy and education are negligible. But people here in Brixton definitely disagree.
They live in their little tower and they've grown up in a certain way, but they don't see the reality of what black people are actually going through. So no, there is racism and we are not hung up. We need to just be heard that something is wrong with our bringing up our lives and how we are actually treated, because in reality we are seen as a different colour.
Institutional racism does exist. It exists in the education system everywhere. You can see it in a classroom. A teacher would discriminate against a black student over a white student just because he's black.
The report has been slammed as nonsense that flies in the face of all existing evidence. Flagged up are many issues that black and minority ethnics grapple on a daily basis. For example, the fact that black people are 9 times more likely to be stopped and searched by police than white people, and black mothers are 4 times likely to die in childbirth. So is this a genuine effort to understand racism in Britain, or a PR stunt? Many black artists share the view that racism today is alive and well. Junior from the British Collective says his life and career were deeply impacted by racism.
When I was a kid and I was growing up, if I played football and a white guy kicked me, I would have turned around and I might have effed him blind. But it wouldn't have crossed my mind to call him white. Vice versa, the first thing that he would do is turn around and say, "You black so-and-so." Not understanding for himself that he's being racist, he just took it as the norm. It hasn't changed. since then. It hasn't changed in any shape, form or fashion. I hear some politicians trying to turn it into, black politicians trying to turn it into a, oh well, we've come a long way. We haven't.
The COVID-19 pandemic and the disproportionate number of deaths among black, Asian and minority ethnic people clearly illustrate that something is seriously wrong. Being much more likely to have to live in a block of flats and do a job involving a high level of exposure to the public are the sort of factors that critics say prove systemic or structural racism is real. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement, Said Hassan Nasrallah, urged Saudi Arabia to immediately end its war on Yemen and lift its blockade on its southern neighbor. Said Nasrallah called on Saudi Arabia not to waste time by proposing deceiving initiatives which lead to nowhere, and stressed that stopping the war and the blockade should be simultaneous. Nasrallah also warned of a Saudi plot to blame Yemen's Ansarullah movement for the ongoing conflict in the war-torn country.
You need to stop the war and end the blockade. Then we can sit and negotiate. Here's where the deception lies. What does it mean if you stop the war without ending the blockade? It means that what they could not realize through a military war, they want to achieve through humanitarian and social pressure.
Elsewhere in his remarks, he said the U.S. is not as strong as before and is on a path toward collapse, while the axis of resistance is gaining power.
America is no longer the America that you knew. There is one main issue that Imam Khamenei has stressed in the last year, and I call on everyone in the region to ponder on that thought. That is the decline of the U.S. America is taking the downward path.
Speaking at an event commemorating late Sheikh Ahmad al-Zin, who was a pioneer in clerics who spoke for Palestine, Nasrallah stressed that the so-called deal of the century has died as a result of the Palestinian people's patience. Observers believe Sayyid Nasrallah's views shows that there is an opportunity for the entire region, even for the Saudis, to be able to stop the crisis of the war they launched on Yemen.
The speech of Sayyid Hassan shows that all regional sides enjoy an opportunity to hold on to their principles and at the same time preserve their achievements. This is true even with the issue of Islamic Republic of Iran and its nuclear program. All of these developments can pave the way for achieving political results.
Hezbollah leader also warned regional countries against relying on the United States. Hezbollah's leader then touched upon the political impasse in Lebanon, calling for the immediate formation of a new government. Hezbollah Secretary General has stressed in his speech that most of the wars in the region, namely in Syria or Yemen, are mainly aimed to target the resistance and the Palestinian cause and to create a Sunni-Shiite rift. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The prosecution in Sheikh Zazaki's trial finally completed the presentation of witnesses when the trial resumed in a Kaduna High Court, where the Islamic cleric is standing trial for culpable homicide on other charges, which he pleaded not guilty. The prosecution lawyer expressed the hope that he will get a conviction following the presentation of credible witnesses.
We presented about 15 witnesses for the prosecution. 15 top army generals that were key actors, key players in the whole of the saga that led to the filing of the charges against Balam Sheikh Zakzaki. One of our prayers is that the court should overrule the no-case submission, overrule the defense, and convict the defendants accordingly and pass the necessary sentence as provided for.
However, Zazaki's defense team dismissed the claim of the prosecution as it affirmed an earlier position that there shouldn't even have been a case against the Islamic cleric.
So far, based on the evidence advanced thus far, all the 15 witnesses so far, in our estimation, has not made any submission or given any evidence that incriminates the defendant in any manner whatsoever. So it's on that basis that we will be entering the no-case submission.
Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat have been in detention for over 5 years, despite the ruling of a federal high court ordering for their release. Over 340 of Sheikh Zazaki's supporters were killed, including three of his biological sons, when soldiers of the Nigerian army attacked his home and worship center in December 2015. Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife Zinat are detained in the Kaduna Correctional Facility, not far from this courthouse where the trial is taking place. Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki has just turned 70, and his supporters are calling for his immediate and unconditional release. Danjum Abdullahi, Kaduna.
The European-wide Islamophobia epidemic has shown little sign of curbing as more countries join the criticized burqa ban. Swiss Muslims have been the latest to feel the effects of hate after a referendum passed banning all face coverings in public spaces.
Être libre, c'est pouvoir montrer son visage.
Being free is to be able to show our face, respect women's dignity, have our own identity, and therefore I do not understand the discourse of people who want to imprison women behind this veil.
Following the ban, I reached out to Zainab, a German national who travels regularly to Switzerland, and asked how the ban has impacted her.
This ban makes me really sad and angry because it's the second article here in the federal constitution against the Islam. I think we have to understand that it's not against the niqab or against the minaret. It's against the global Islam. It's just an Islamophobia act. And I think they are not finished. They are looking for the next step.
The ban isn't the first anti-Islam move adopted by the Swiss, as I found out after speaking to the Islamic Central Council of Switzerland.
I just can confirm you, I mean, Swiss chocolate is great. Even we Muslims, we love it. And Toblerone is now even halal, so it's a great thing, yeah? In terms of Islamophobia, this is less great, yes, indeed. Actually, we are indeed suffering since 2009, when this first referendum came up against the minarets, which has been indeed banned with 57.3% of the Swiss population voting yes for this ban. We are constantly, during the last 10 years as a community, have been attacked by the media, have been the target of certain stereotypes.
Local campaigners and activists have vowed to fight back against the ban. However, the global Muslim attention fixed elsewhere. The defenders of Islam in Switzerland have yet to receive the support they deserve.
The reasons behind enforcing the ban vary from country to country, with some claiming it's a security threat, while others simply say that it contradicts Western ideals. Now, whatever the excuse, the traumatizing effect that the ban has on devout Muslim women has been made clear by those who suffer from its enforcement. Robert Carter, London.
The Beit al-Futuh Mosque in London, one of the largest in Western Europe, hosting a pop-up vaccine clinic to boost inoculation rates and overcome vaccine hesitancy amid the many myths that have been created around the pandemic.
NHS approached us and they said with the idea of a pop-up clinic here, vaccination clinic, and you know we welcomed it. Our community has had an abnormally high number of people that have suffered from the virus.
We dispel the myths about microchips and blood clots and answer their queries. Some are really concerned about their fertility.
British scientists say there is a historical trend of lower vaccine uptake in areas with a higher proportion of ethnic minority groups in England.
A recent study found that a high percentage of people from Pakistani or Bangladeshi origin said they were unlikely to be vaccinated. Among black Britons, the figure stands at more than 40%, the highest of all ethnic groups in this country, meaning that some of the most vulnerable people are the least likely to get the jab.
And that's a concern for the British government, which plans to inoculate every adult in the country with the first dose of the vaccine by the end of summer. Online, videos distorting people's understanding of the virus and the vaccines abound. This one, that claims silver solution kills the virus, was proved false by a news channel. Conspiracy theories have deepened public distrust in medical science.
Well, I think there have been some indication among South Asians for the Indian community that there might be some element of beef in the vaccine, that it might be unsafe. Particularly, there's been these questions of whether there's any pork content, porcine content, pig content to the vaccine. which there is not, but those rumours have been going amongst the Pakistani community in particular, which is large in our country, and they are false accusations.
Among some black Britons, a sense of unease. They don't trust the government. Some fear there might be different vaccines for black and white people. This week, a video featuring high-profile black figures urging black Britons to take the vaccine.
But we're asking you to trust the facts about the vaccine from our own professors, scientists, and doctors.
Vaccine hesitancy also extends to ultra-Orthodox Jewish communities, mostly over fears it might contain pork. Or from the perspective of this controversial rabbi, popular on YouTube, it might alter people's sexual orientation. Conspiracy theorists exploit a lack of trust in the government and a health system that to some ethnic minorities appears to favor white people and the more affluent. The British government's challenge now is to build trust in the vaccines proven to save lives. Saeed Pourizza, London.
Following a late cabinet meeting, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan announced his government's decision to reinstate a total lockdown on weekends in most Turkish states. The decision came after the number of daily infections with coronavirus reached more than 30,000. Erdogan also stated that during the holy month of Ramadan, the weekend lockdown and daily curfew from 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. will continue, with restaurants only serving delivery and takeouts.
During the month of Ramadan, restaurants and cafes in Turkey will only be allowed to deliver food as part of the measures against the COVID-19 pandemic, as weekend curfews will again be in place on Saturdays.
A week ago, Turkish president had refused to tighten restrictions. He said, although the number of daily infections is high, the number of those hospitalized is less. Some criticize what they call the government's double standards in dealing with the situation, as it is preventing wedding parties and home visits, while the ruling party is organizing conferences to promote for 2023 elections.
Of course, infection rates will continue to rise due to the majority not abiding by the instructions. For example, when the government eased restrictions on restaurants and cafes and were all allowed to operate without preventive frameworks, people and restaurants themselves did not abide by the measures. However, you cannot ask people to be careful and follow restriction guidance when you hold popular gatherings to promote your party for the elections. This contradicts your own statements and measures. On the one hand, they stress the need to adhere to social distancing and the use of protective masks, and on the other, they organize public conferences with public attendance.
Turkish president said that 80% of Turkey's citizens live in high-risk provinces, including the capital Ankara and the biggest city in the country, Istanbul. The government now hopes that by the end of the holy month of Ramadan, the majority of Turkish citizens and residents would be vaccinated so that Turkey can welcome tourists again. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.